Welcome to you all from State Records New South Wales. I'm very pleased to be speaking to you today on our open day. Before we can start, can I ask if any of you here have a convict ancestor? Yep, oh, quite a few. Okay. Anyone whose ancestor arrived between 1788 and 1801? Good, quite a few again. Do we have any from the Third Fleet? Yes, oh, well represented, okay. What about the Second Fleet? Oh, yes, a good crowd, okay. And any from the First Fleet? Yes, very pleased to see you today. Now, some of you might know that my own fifth great-grandfather also arrived on the First Fleet, and he was John Nichols, and he arrived on the Scarborough. And if you're interested, left corner of the slide there, we have the First Fleet Ferry Scarborough. Now, today I want to tell you about State Records' major digitalisation project called Sentence Beyond the Seas, Australia's early convict records. And it's those records from 1788 to 1801. It is State Records' free gift to the people of Australia and the world to mark 225 years this year since the arrival of the First Fleet at Sydney Cove on the 26th of January 1788. And you can see that for me, being the project coordinator for Sentence Beyond the Seas was a labour of love. Sentence Beyond the Seas is a project to digitise and index Australia's earliest convict records. We have digitised in colour from the original records for the first time ever. You can find the project from State Records' homepage, which is records.nsw.gov.au, by clicking on the quick link to convict records, or you can also find it via our online indexes. I'd especially like to point out that a project such as Sentence Beyond the Seas combines the efforts of many people at State Records and also our partner institutions. Without their efforts, it would not have been possible to provide this online project. The names of all those who were involved are given on the Sentence Beyond the Seas project homepage. Some of you might be wondering why Sentence Beyond the Seas was the name that we came up for the project. In keeping with our theme today, I'll mention that transportation is the act of sending convicted criminals across the seas to serve their sentences. Transportation was introduced in 1597 by the Elizabethan Act for the punishment of rogues, vagabonds and sturdy beggars. Well, the convicts of Australia's First Fleet had originally been sentenced to be transported to America, Africa or simply to parts beyond the seas. The British Act 24 George II, 1784, Chapter 12, an act to authorise the removal of prisoners in certain cases and to amend the laws respecting the transportation of offenders, provided for the destination to be changed to any proper place beyond the seas, if transportation to the place originally named in their sentence cannot be conveniently executed. In August 1786, the decision was made to establish a settlement at Botany Bay. The 11 ships that became known as the First Fleet comprised the convict transport ships Alexander, Charlotte, Friendship, Lady Penrhyn, Prince of Wales and Scarborough, the naval ships HMS Sirius and HMS Supply, and the store ships Borrowdale, Fishburne and Golden Grove. The First Fleet, under the command of Captain Arthur Phillip in HMS Sirius, set sail from Portsmouth on the 13th of May of 1787, arriving at Botany Bay from the 18th to the 20th of January 1788. Phillip then explored Port Jackson and there found the finest harbour in the world, in which 1,000 sail of the line may ride in the most perfect security. He chose Sydney Cove as the site of the settlement, and on the 26th of January 1788, the convicts were landed there. The colony of New South Wales was then established under Governor Arthur Phillip. The early convict index, part of our project, includes the names of all the convicts mentioned in the digitised records. There are over 12,000 names in the early convict index and over 850 linked images. All the records can be viewed from the list of ships included in the project, available from the homepage. The names include not just those who actually arrived, but even those whose names were crossed off the list. Some of them may have been intended to be sent. Some may have actually boarded the ships but disembarked before they sailed through illness or some other cause. Some of those convicts may have arrived by a later ship. So you might find that your second fleet convict was originally intended to be transported on the first fleet, but missed the boat. The early convict records of New South Wales are a collection of various documents. These comprise orders in council, indents, lists of convicts, plus related documents. Indents are the basic convict document recording their names, where they were tried, and when they were tried, and the lengths of their sentences. This one here is order in council number one for the first fleet. On it is noted, from this to folio 33 is the register of the first fleet, which arrived here under Governor Phillip, the 26th of January 1788, and it is dated at the Court of St James, the 6th of December 1786. The project included digitising the alphabetical indents from 1788 to 1800. You just might find some more information about your convict in the alphabetical indents because there are annotations for tickets of leave, certificates of freedom, and a few dates and places of death. For some, there is a note giving the name of the ship on which they left the colony. In my case, the alphabetical indent records that John Nichols died at Sydney, December 26, 1822, aged 67. Not everyone in the records actually made it as far as New South Wales. This is a page for the ship Albemarle. We can see that poor Owen Lyons here was actually executed on the way. And very nicely they recorded exactly the latitude and the longitude where he died. I've got a couple of stories for you from the First Fleet. Thomas Barrett, you can see him there, was first embarked in 1784 on the Mercury for America, but never reached there. The convicts on that ship took over the ship before they even left English waters, but were later captured and sent to Exeter jails. As a mutineer, Barrett should have received the death penalty, but was reprieved as he had saved the life of a steward. In 1787, he was sent to New South Wales on the Charlotte. Barrett was the leader of three men who stole beef and peas from the colony stores on the 27th of February 1788, so he actually made it here. Found guilty the same day by the first criminal court, he became the first person executed in New South Wales. Thomas Barrett has been attributed also as a skillful maker of the Charlotte medal, which is held by the Australian National Maritime Museum. James Squires. He embarked on the Charlotte as well for New South Wales. Squires cultivated hops after his arrival. He built the first brewery in New South Wales and opened the Malting Shovel Tavern in the Ryde area. On the 14th of March of 1806, he presented two vines of hops to the government and received the gift of a cow. Squires died in 1822, aged 67. The well-known brewing company bearing his name still exists today. And I do love the names given to the beer, such as Nine Tails, Stowaway, or 150 Lashes. You can see the original of those two records, Squires and Barrett, in our reading room today. The records can lead us to some quite remarkable stories. Robert Pierce, alias Arnold, was tried at London on the 23rd of May of 1792, and his indent shows that he was to be transported to New South Wales for 7 years. He had been tried for breaking and entering the dwelling house of George Baker and Richard Baker on the 20th of January 1792. With John Lewis, he had stolen three pieces of thread lace, valued at £20. A seven-year sentence would have expired on the 23rd of May of 1799. He arrived in New South Wales on the ship Ganges. Now, the problem is that Robert Pierce's sentence was actually life, not 7 years. Governor Hunter allowed Pierce to return to England on the same ship as he travelled in January of 1801. Unfortunately for Pierce, he was recognised in London and was indicted for being found at large before the expiration of the term for which he was ordered to be transported. As return from transportation meant the death sentence, this was quite serious. At the Old Bailey, Governor Hunter himself testified on behalf of Pierce. The prisoner declared Governor Hunter looked into the books there and saw I was entered for 7 years only, and thinking my time was out, I asked Governor Hunter to permit me to come over with him, and he brought me over. Hunter testified of Pierce. He applied to me some time before I quitted the country in consequence of his time being expired, upon which I desired him to bring me a note from the Secretary's office. He was asked, "Is your Secretary's name at Botany Bay Fulks?" and answered, "He is one of the clerks in the office." Pierce gave Hunter the note, but Hunter said, "I ordered the books to be brought to me, not choosing to give credit to any note." And when these books were produced to me, he appeared to stand on these books for 7 years. He was asked, "Did there appear to be any erasure or attempted erasure?" Hunter replied, "Not that I observed. It was the original list that was sent from England that I examined." He noted, "The list that comes from England is what we always look at." I actually checked the sentences of those above and below Pierce here. Peter Gatenby was indeed sentenced to life. Charles Williams was sentenced to 14 years. Both William Thompson and James Jones were sentenced to 7 years. Now, the certificate that Robert Pierce held read, "Robert Pierce, otherwise Arnold, age 40, London, 23rd of May, 1792, 7 years. Extracted from the Ganges Register, Francis Fulks, Secretary's Office, Sydney Cove, 20th of April, 1800. Now, it is possible that this was simply a case of transcription error in the record, but it is more likely that it was not. You see, when Governor King took over from Governor Hunter, he discovered that there were upwards of 200 convicts who had left the colony before their sentences had expired. King issued two general orders on this problem on the 3rd of October 1800 and again on the 4th of August 1801. Through the knavery of the governor's clerk, some prisoners had paid considerable sums of money, watches, etc., for the purpose of altering their terms of transportation from life to shorter rates, most of which have expired. Governor King complained that the number of erasures in the convict's term of transportation has introduced such confusion into the indents and orders in council that came with them that very few men's times can be ascertained. He estimated upwards of 200 people have left this colony whose terms are not expired. What to do in this, I do not know. It cannot happen again, as I have kept the books in my own possession ever since I have taken the command, but unfortunately the mischief was done before. This brings us to the story of Edward Turley Smith. I have to thank Cathy Mercer from Inside History magazine for alerting me to this convict's story. Smith came on the Marquess Cornwallis, and he was listed as a convicted at Cork in 1793. He came from Ireland. And his sentence was possibly 7 years or possibly life. You can see the record has been altered at some point. Smith was actually tried in Cork in October of 1794, together with his brother James Smith and Humphrey Moore, alias Mendoza, for highway robbery, and all were to receive the death sentence, but were reprieved on condition they be transported for their lives. Edward Smith was charged in March 1802 for giving Francis Fulks £12 for altering his sentence from being a prisoner for life to appear upon the books for 7 years only, and that Smith, in consequence thereof, has obtained his certificate. That the money was paid to Fulks upon or about the middle of the month of May 1800, in the presence of this witness, Pat Hines. That Smith prevailed on all who knew he was for life and who were in the same jail with him to bribe Fulks and procure their certificates, also fearing that unless they were in his own situation, they might betray him. That Fulks had given upwards of 200 false certificates to Smith's acquaintances and accumulated some £600 thereby. That these people spent a vast deal of money with Smith, which was the meaning of him being in the habits of selling liquor. Came as a convict on the Alexander on the First Fleet. He was tried at the sessions at the Old Bailey on the 13th of December 1786 and sentenced to 7 years. Fortunately for Francis Fulks, he had already left the colony on the 21st of October 1800 and landed at the Cape of Good Hope on the 28th of February 1801. He was noted in May 1804 as being resident of the Cape. Interestingly, Fulks sailed to the Cape on the Buffalo, which was the same ship that Governor John Hunter and the unexpired convict Robert Pierce took to England. So Fulks got away with his colonial crime. Now I'd like to tell you the story of Sir Henry Brown Hayes. He was the first owner of Vaucluse House. He had been knighted in 1790. Sir Henry was a wealthy Irish convict who was sentenced to life imprisonment in New South Wales for having abducted and forcibly married a wealthy Cork heiress for her inheritance. The grossly insulted lady, however, rejected Sir Henry's illegal approach to marriage, and he was forced to flee. He was consequently declared an outlaw and was hunted for the next 2 years, with a large reward promised for his capture. At the end of 2 years, he handed himself in for a trial. He was tried in court, found guilty and sentenced to hang, but his sentence was commuted to life imprisonment when both the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland and the Chancellor of Ireland overturned the judge's death sentence. Now, you might be wondering why I'm telling you about a convict who actually arrived in 1802, when the Sentence Beyond the Seas project only digitised records for arrivals up to 1801. Well, Sir Henry Brown Hayes is in those records, though not as a convict. The receipt of the naval agent for the Queen Transport, the first ship to bring convicts to New South Wales directly from Ireland, records that the bodies of 130 male and 22 female convicts were received from the Right Worshipful Richard Harris Esquire, Mayor of the City of Cork, Charles Ferguson Esquire, and Sir Henry Brown Hayes, Town Sheriff of the said city. And this document is dated April 1791. So here we have a man who both sent convicts to New South Wales and who became one of them himself. Henry Brown Hayes sailed on the 29th of November of 1801 from Ireland and arrived on the Atlas I on the 7th of July of 1802. He was simply listed then as H.B. Hayes, age 48, Dry Cork, City Cork, Spring 1801, for life. Knighted in 1790, Hayes had been transported in 1801 on the Atlas for the crime of kidnapping. He was exiled to Norfolk Island and to Van Diemen's Land following acts of defiance towards Governor King, and in 1808 and 1809 was sent to Newcastle for expressing support for the deposed Bligh. He was pardoned by Macquarie and departed the colony in December of 1812. 15 years later, in 1827, William Charles Wentworth purchased the Vaucluse property and rebuilt the house. Only a few sandstone blocks of the first Vaucluse house remain in the foundations of Wentworth's house. Sir Henry Brown Hayes himself died in 1832, a free man. Just going to show a few other examples in the records that we have. This one is for John Macklin, who arrived in Sydney on the Barwell in May of 1798. Now, he was a private in the 86th Regiment of Foot, and he was charged with mutiny. We learn from this document that he was guilty of a breach of the Articles of War. His sentence was 1,000 lashes, in the usual manner, and to be transported to Botany Bay. This one here is actually a document from one of our partner institutions from the State Library of New South Wales. And this one is about the ship Anne, which arrived in 1800. And down here we have Mary Donaghy. And we picked up a bit of interesting information about her here. It actually says that she lives at Windsor with a Sawyer of the name of McLaren. And below her we can see Eleanor Walsh, who had stowed away. James Cannon was a seaman belonging to His Majesty's ship, the Tremendous, who, having been tried by a court-martial on the 2nd of February 1799 for charges of having beat a boatswain's mate when in the execution of his office, insulting a midshipman and making use of mutinous and seditious expressions, and was sentenced by the said court to suffer death, but having conducted himself in a very penitent manner since that sentence was pronounced on him, I have pardoned him upon the condition of his serving as convict for the term of 5 years in the colony of New South Wales. James Watkins, alias Watson, arrived on the Ganges. He had been sentenced at Middlesex on the 16th of September 1795 for 7 years. James Watkins, alias Watson, wrote in 1804, "I have now been detained a prisoner in this colony upwards of 2 years over the expiration of my sentence, which originates from my being convicted in the name of James Watson, but being universally known by most people here, they continue to call me by my own name of Watkins. Thus it was that on application to His Excellency for permission to leave the colony, having previously got shipped for England, I was refused the liberty of leaving on account of the name. In consequence, I am still detained. Now, sir, could I so far prevail upon your generosity as to write a few lines to Governor King enclosing a copy of my conviction in the session's paper? It would do away every remaining doubt and enable an unfortunate man to return to his native country. With respect, your obedient humble servant, James Watkins. James Wall was a soldier in the 84th Regiment at the Cape of Good Hope. His sentence on the 21st of May of 1798 was death, commuted to life. James Wall was tried by a general court-martial, held in the Castle of Good Hope on the 21st day of May last for desertion. He was sentenced by that court to be shot to death, but His Excellency the Governor was pleased to pardon the prisoner on condition of being transported to New South Wales for life, and he has in consequence been shipped on board the ship Cornwallis. Lawrence Murphy was an Irishman who arrived on the French ship too, on the 16th of February of 1800. He was guilty of aiding in rebellion and plundering the house of Mr. Whitty. And I do like the description of Michael Keefe. Michael Keefe here. Idle and disorderly. One of the most fascinating stories I've learnt in putting together this project is that the alphabetical indents themselves. Some of you will have already read the story briefly in Inside History in January this year. There are two volumes of alphabetical indents covering the years 1788 to 1800. The first volume covers the letters A to V, and the second volume has V to Y. There are no Zs. Let's take a trip back to the start of the 20th century. On the 28th of August of 1901, a committee was formed of the Principal Undersecretary of the Chief Secretary's Office, the Inspector General of Police, and the Registrar General to inquire into the best method of disposing of certain convict records. They considered that the records may be imperial convict records and hence be subject to the English Public Records Act. So they wrote to Downing Street to get the advice of the Secretary of State for the Colonies. In June of 1902, samples of these records were forwarded to London for inspection. They arrived on the SS Ophir about the 11th of August of 1902 and were sent to the Colonial Office Library. No decision as to their ownership was made at that time, and the records subsequently found their way to the Public Record Office, now known as the National Archives of the United Kingdom, also a partner in this project. Well, the second volume was recognised among the volumes copied onto microfilm by the Australian Joint Copying Project. One of the archivists at the time, Dawn Troy, realised we only had the first volume but were missing the second part of the alphabetical sequence. She found it on the microfilm and wondered why it was in England at the Public Record Office. Dawn not only discovered why it was there, but set about getting it returned to Australia. In October 1972, the then Archives Authority resolved to approach the Public Record Office to request the return of these records. The return was agreed on the 31st of October of 1973. The records were to be sent back on the ship Botany Bay, which would have been most appropriate, but were transferred to the MV Abel Tasman due to industrial trouble on the English wharves. And the records were finally returned to the Archives Office of New South Wales on the 18th of June 1974, and of course they are here today at State Records. The volume had been rebound by the Public Record Office, but the original label here was retained as part of the new binding. We see this label on the screen there. Thus, the volume itself and this label crossed the world twice, while for many of comics the trip was strictly one way. A few books I've used for the talk there, and I just thought I'd show you how we digitise the records. Thank you.